All right, the third case and final case set for argument this morning is appeal number 31074, Vivo X Point versus Daniel Sendorf. We have Judge Ann Hoffman, who is sitting with us this morning in place of Justice Robert Kaczynski. She's a Second Circuit judge. We appreciate her sitting with us on the constituted court. Eric Schlumgen will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, Vivo X Point, and Matthew Hayes McCoy will be arguing on behalf of Appellee Sendorf. Each side will have 15 minutes, and then Mr. Schlumgen, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal, and you can proceed with your argument at this time.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, counsel, my name is Eric Schlumgen. I represent Vivo's X Point. As a brief outline to the court, Vivo's position is first that the circuit court erred in exceeding the jurisdiction that it had within the forcible entry and detainer statutory scheme in deciding the issue of whether the lease is an illusory contract. Second, even if the circuit court had jurisdiction, it erred in finding that the lease was an illusory contract. For the benefit of the court and the audience, I'd give a brief factual summation if the court deemed appropriate.
Go ahead.
Vivo's is the owner of Vivo's X Point. It's a survivalist community out by Edgemont, South Dakota. It consists of 575 decommissioned military bunkers, which previously stored munitions, ammo, and were operated by the Army from 1942 to 1967. Vivo's then purchased the bunker community and made the survivalist compound that it is today. Individuals then would have the ability to lease a bunker from Vivo's for a term of 99 years. One individual who entered into a lease was Daniel Sendorf. Mr. Sendorf entered a lease on July 20th. The lease contained a clause, paragraph 10, that Vivo's may modify the community rules from time to time so long as 30 days notice is given. The next clause, paragraph 11, stated the lease may not be modified except by a written agreement. The community rules, which were attached to the lease, were of March 2020. In November 2021, Vivo's exercised its ability to modify the community rules and regulations. In November of 2021, Vivo's added the word brandish, that no community member may brandish a firearm outside of the shooting range. That notice was provided to Mr. Sendorf, and the parties operated under that amended community rules. In July of 2023, there was an altercation that took place, and there's competing testimony as to what exactly happened. Mr. Sendorf was riding a motorcycle around a bunker that was being built out by Vivo's contractors, and there's a dispute as to whether dogs were on a long tethered leash or not leashed at all. What occurred next is the dogs went near the motorcycle and Mr. Sendorf brandished a firearm. And in doing so, the firearm was brandished to two individuals, Stephanie Dundas and J.R. Rodriguez. And it was the position of Vivo's that brandishing the firearm was in violation of the community rules and regulations.
So my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that by brandishing, you're saying he actually pointed the weapon at them.
The firearm was unholstered, it was drawn, and aimed, yes, in the direction of a human being.
But of course, there's been no fact-finding on any of that.
That is correct.
And what brings us here really isn't that. Or a referendum on whether this is a good lease, a bad lease, or, well, a little bit. But really, it's a narrow, narrow issue, right? This is an eviction action and an effort to just determine the issue of lawful immediate possession, whether it exists or not. So your argument about the lease, and sketch out maybe if you could, I'm getting ahead of you, your principal argument for this lease is it's not enforceable. Why?
Justice Alter, that's absolutely correct. And the issue that we would ascertain to this court is that the circuit court exceeded its jurisdiction and that possession is the only question here. And whether the lease is illusory or not, a good lease or a bad lease.
And illusory means it's just... there's no consideration. It's not a bilateral contract.
Correct. Right? And we would assert that's one, improper.
What's the consequence, though, if a contract really isn't a contract and it's illusory, then what? Do you have a contract at all?
Justice Salter, I would say that that matters based on which party is asserting that claim.
Well, that's my question to you, though.
If Vivos was asserting that claim, yes, that would matter, as Vivos would be, we are brought this eviction pursuant to SDCL 21-16-1 sub 7, that there was a violation of a lease. If we were asserting that the lease was invalid or did not exist, that would matter. That would be a problem. The defendant, the party being evicted, however, is the party asserting that there is no valid lease agreement. Our position is that, in effect, they're conceding they don't have a property interest to remain at that tenancy.
So wouldn't that end it?
Well, yes, that would end it.
And that would be a reversal, right? Because if they don't have a lease, or they don't have a continuing right to possession, which is all we're concerned about here, what are we fighting about?
Well, Your Honor, the position of Vivos would be that the circuit court's order that...
Right, that would be corrected. But I mean, under your argument, but I mean, what if we're only talking about possession, and if the consequence of the argument is, yeah, there's no lease, would you win on that?
Correct. And we'd ask to win on that issue, that if that's Vivos's, we would not like to win on the fact, and we're not in any way consenting to the circuit court's finding that the lease was illusory. If the court remands and states that due to the position of defendant, that defendant concedes there is no lease interest, Vivos would agree to taking possession under those terms, but we're not asking this court to adopt the finding of the circuit court that the lease was illusory.
Maybe it's not a live controversy. If their argument goes nowhere and doesn't prove possession at all, is there even a live controversy?
Justice Salter, I would agree that there is some determination as to the relief sought in the complaint that is left to be desired, as the order here does not state as to possession. It states the lease, the circuit court's order is that the lease is illusory. It does not go to the relief sought or the meat of what a forcible entry and detainer action is, as to whom should have possession and under what terms of possession they should have.
But you want to go back under your lease and say, violated the lease, we want possession of the property. That's what you're looking for.
Yes.
I mean, that's ultimately the relief you want, is we have a valid lease, we're entitled to possession because he violated the terms of that lease, we gave him notice, terminated, we're entitled to possession of the property.
Yes, Chief Justice, and to Justice Salter's point, if that requires the circuit court to consider the position raised by the defendant, Sindorf, that there is no valid lease interest, I think that could be.
If you have a lease, right, would you go back, only in the scenario where a lease exists, would you go back and have a trial, because you moved for summary judgment as well.
Correct.
Because you haven't really appealed that. I mean, it's in your docketing statement, but it doesn't look like you're really asking for that. It looks like you're asking, correct me if I'm wrong.
You're correct.
But your brief says, we just want this reversed. So if it's reversed, and if there's no lease, well, then that's one thing. I think it seems like it's over then. But if there is some sort of a lease, there was consideration, there's something binding there, wouldn't you then have to have a trial on whether Mr. Sindorf actually brandished this gun or not, factually, and violated the rules and yielded any right to possession? Wouldn't that be the outcome in that scenario?
Yes. If there is a valid lease,
yeah,
and there is a question as to the circuit court on how to proceed under the terms of saying a party did or did not do something within the terms of the lease, then yes, there would have to be a trial as to that specific violation, and that would be a trial that would have to happen to the court, and it would be only relating to the issue of possession. SDCL 21-16-4 states an action under the provision of this chapter cannot be brought in connection with any other except for rents and profits or damages, but plaintiff may bring a separate action for the same if he so desires. And our contention is that The circuit court was correct when it granted Vivos's motion to dismiss the counterclaims. It was initially denied, and the circuit court then vacated and did grant Vivos's motion to dismiss of all of Sindorf's counterclaims. However, somewhat paradoxically and at the same time, Sindorf started a separate civil action asserting the same causes of action and relief pled within the complaint, pled within the answer, and then likewise moved for summary judgment. However, there was no basis, there was no claims existing to authorize the court to enter summary judgment on Sindorf's behalf, as the answer was, answer and counterclaims were dismissed by the court. So I believe that's an additional jurisdictional basis that the circuit court erred in granting summary judgment when there were no counterclaims to rely on for that basis.
So the inevitable claims that they are going to make as to the improvements that they've made to the bunker, is that something that can be brought in the FED, or is that something that needs to be brought in an entirely separate action?
Justice, I would contend that's a separate action, and that's appropriate under the separate civil action that was filed by Mr. Sindorf against Vivos, and I believe.
And that was your argument for the dismissal, right?
Yes.
Look, this is out of bounds on this FED action.
Yes, and this is somewhat in opposite of the other lineage of cases by this court, be Vore Inc. v. O'Farrell and Stock v. Garrett, that those cases already had proceedings, and a party tried to join the forcible entry and detainer as a compulsory counterclaim. This has started with the forcible entry and detainer, and the party objecting to the forcible entry and detainer is trying to add in claims which are improper under the authority and scope of the court based on what the legislature has narrowly and inflexibly designed a forcible entry and detainer action to be about, which is possession and only the issue of possession.
So in any event, though, there's no consequence to them not appealing that dismissal here, because starting a new action is entirely what you would have envisioned anyway.
I believe there is a consequence of Sindorf not appealing the circuit court's dismissal.
What is it?
The issue is that they should not have been able to bring a motion for summary judgment, as there's no underlying claims for judgment to be brought. And it's a further basis that those claims, there might be a res judicata argument within the other cause of action, but moreover, it's more grounds that it's not appropriate for this circuit court, under the only titling, which is forcible entry and detainer, to hear those causes of action.
Well, but could they use it as an affirmative defense to possession and say, you know, that term in the lease isn't valid, can't use that as a basis to terminate the lease and evict us? Is that a valid affirmative defense that could be asserted?
Chief Justice, respectfully, no, it was not raised as an affirmative defense in their answer. The counterclaim's been dismissed, and I don't believe you can have both a lease that's void or fully illegal and also contest a claim or a provision that was added on and say that this add-on to the lease that we're saying the whole lease is illegal is no longer a basis for an eviction.
But in the end, all we're really looking at is possession, of course, here. And is there an argument in this case that provides a theory for your opponents to say, yeah, we win, we're entitled to continuing possession? I'm having a hard time seeing that. I know it's a question that I'll ask your friends on the other side as well.
Yes, I agree with Justice Salter that the main question of the scope of this action is possession. And our position is that the lower court's order has not fully defined and addressed that issue of how possession will look going forward. The circuit court granted summary judgment on the basis of the lease being illusory. What's undetermined is how possession will go forward. There's not, as previous cases of this court, a 10-year add-on or an oral lease that could be adopted by the parties. I believe there's further clarification needed for a final order of the circuit court as to that issue.
Well, in the absence of a contract, they would have to establish some other possessory right before the court, some other right to possess the property that doesn't arise out of this contract, out of this lease.
Correct, Justice. And if there's no basis or no existing lease, I don't know if that would go to a month by month or what that would even be. If there's not a lease that ended, I don't know that it would necessarily go to even a month-to-month agreement or if the court would define them as trespassers. I don't know what interests these people.
And to this point in the litigation, have they asserted any other source of right to possession? Besides,
apologize.
Have they asserted any other source to the right to possession?
No, the assertion that I believe is being made here is as to the unjust enrichment claim. And I think that's what if the lease is invalid and improvements have been made or payments have been made for a 99-year lease term, I would argue that the assertion of summary judgment goes to the claims of unjust enrichment, but it does not go to possession. And I don't believe there's been any colorable claims made as to how Sindorf would have possession of a bunker made before the circuit court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayes, McCoy, you may proceed.
So let's jump right to that. Assuming that your argument is correct and the contract was illusory and there is no, it doesn't exist, what's your source of your right to possess the bunker?
Well, the base case is a month-to-month lease, right? So let's skip back to the complaint. So the complaint alleges that my client, Mr. Sindorf, should be evicted for violation of the lease terms, right? That's their sole basis for eviction. So what they're asking the court to do is to enforce the lease. Well, the court cannot enforce an illegal lease. And so as that's their sole basis for
nobody can. You can't either because it's not there. So what will be your right to possession?
A month-to-month lease is the base case.
We're way past that. Notice to quit is a long time ago, and so continuing, on the question of immediate possession, what argument exists that your client's entitled to immediate possession? Narrow case.
Yeah, so first of all, the notice to quit is no longer necessary in South Dakota, but also it goes to the basis of the eviction, right? And so their basis of the eviction is a violation of the lease.
Seems like a Pyrrhic victory, though. So maybe you win this case because they didn't plead it out that way, but they bring the next FED saying, okay, now.
Well, they certainly can, but they haven't, right? And so what you're asking us to do is to defend a future eviction based on our base case month-to-month lease. Well, that hasn't happened yet. All they've done is alleged eviction based on terms of a lease that we don't think are enforceable.
Does your client own the bunker?
He leases it for 99 years.
Okay. So what would give him a legal theory to continued possession?
When you have an agreement to possess a property as a tenant and the lease becomes invalid, the base case is a month-to-month lease. I mean, that's in the statute.
So they have to give a month notice?
They would have to restart the process.
Didn't they give a 30-day notice?
Well, that's my point. They give you these notice to quit. And I'm not talking about notice to quit in the eviction process. They're giving you notice. Clearly, it seems like, when they're saying, we want you to vacate.
Yeah, but the basis matters here, right? So if you're saying, we want you to quit because you brandished a firearm, and again, we dispute that he brandished a firearm, but it's our summary judgment motion, so for facts, I guess he did. But that's their only basis, right? And so if that's not a violation of the lease, then that's not a valid basis for eviction. And so you're asking us to do is to then say, okay, well,
we're not asking you to do anything.
He's eventually going to send a 30-day notice, and so then we have to preempt that with some additional defenses. They haven't done that yet. And to answer your question, Chief Justice, I'm not sure if there was a 30-day notice. I don't think so. In my recollection, the only notices given to my client, or really for this entire litigation, was we're evicting you due to breaches of the lease.
Isn't it really about the cost of improvements? I mean, is your client really trying to retain possession, or is your client really interested in recovering the cost of valuable improvements that he's made to the property after he loses possession?
Yeah, or you could rewrite the lease. So another avenue here is that they could renegotiate the lease, right? There's hundreds of people who have leased these properties. If this lease is invalid, well, they could just renegotiate a new lease. There's tons of options for them.
But that requires consent of both parties.
Yes.
To do that. If Vivo's exponent says, we don't have any interest in renegotiating with you,
you're done, aren't you?
Well, they would have to send a notice to terminate.
Right.
Well,
But after 30 days, what do you have left?
Nothing after 30 days. And then all we would have is our unjust enrichment claim. That's true.
And that's a standalone claim. You can't be brought in the FED.
That was ruled at the trial court level, yes.
And you don't disagree with that?
I think it goes to rent, and I think it goes to damages. But again, the trial court ruled that way. I do disagree because
On the dismissal of the counterclaims?
Yeah, because I think that...
But you haven't appealed that.
We haven't, no. We just
so that one's kind of, the die's kind of cast on that one.
It is. Okay, so if I may go to the...
the illusoriness.
The illusoriness, right. So you asked, what is an illusory promise, right? It's a contracts require offer, acceptance, and valid consideration. Valid consideration is a binding promise, right? So if you make a promise that's not binding, then it's not valid consideration. It's not a contract at its outset. I believe one of you asked the question about, well, if it's illusory, is it a contract? It's not at its outset. You don't wait until someone makes a change, and then that appears that it's become unveiled that it's illusory, and then it's invalid then. It's invalid at its outset because you need to be bound at its outset. Because if one party's not bound, that changes the dynamic of the deal, right? If one party's bound but one party's not, they can act differently throughout the contract even if they don't inevitably make a change.
And what's the basis for your theory that this is illusory, that they can change the rules and regulations?
Yeah, so the unfettered ability to modify or terminate a contract is what makes an illusory
promise. Is that what this lease says?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor.
And why do you think that? And because it seems like it's confined to the ability to change the rules and regulations, and it doesn't seem like it's as broad as that.
So you can call them rules and regulations, but they're material parts of the lease. They're wrapped into the lease by the lease's terms, and they're in their complaint, they allege that they're material parts of the lease.
And they all relate to things that affect that community, quality of life, that sort of thing, health, general welfare, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they can change those. How does that deprive the entire lease of any consideration bilaterally?
Again, it's the unfettered ability to modify the terms. And so
the terms, the rules and regulations.
Yes, understood. So if the modification clause says we can only modify the rules and regulations according to the purpose of that document, I would agree with you. But it doesn't say that. They can add in whatever term they want to into the rules and regulations.
So wouldn't the overarching requirement of good faith, fair dealing come into play here, to still put some boundaries on what could be done?
Yeah, so I understand that argument. So first of all, if it's illusory, it's not a contract at its outset. And the good faith and fair dealing covenants deal only with contracts. And so the argument that opposing counsel has raised regarding that covenant essentially nullifies the illusory promise doctrine. Because what they're saying is, well, if it's illusory promise, we can just cure it by the good faith doctrine. Well, the illusory promise doctrine must exist. It's in the restatement of contracts, so we know it exists. So if you're going to follow that argument, you need to determine, okay, where is the distinction between the good faith covenant matters here, but it also doesn't just extinguish the illusory promise as a doctrine altogether. And if you look at the good faith and fair dealing cases, none of them deal with contract modification clauses. They all deal with performance and things like that. And the reason why this is different is because he can modify performance.
Well, you're talking about the arbitration cases, right, that are in your brief, maybe.
So I was actually talking about the good faith and fair dealing cases.
Yeah, I know you were. Whatever I said, I thought you were. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So the good faith and fair dealing cases, just to wrap this up, deal with performance issues and things of that nature. They don't deal with modification clauses. And as I explained in my brief, if there was a modification element to those cases, it would be a fundamentally different outcome. Because here, it's not about whether they performed or not. It's about they can change performance, right?
So let's say we reverse the court's determination that this is an illusory contract. So you go back. Where do you sit at that point?
Well, my client's extremely vulnerable Because like I said in the oral argument at the trial court level, they could change this lease such that my client has to pay $1 million a day.
I can't conceive of that. And I read that, and maybe this is what you're talking about with Justice Devaney, but in no way it seems to me under the rules that are implicated under good faith and fair dealing could one party completely deprive another party of the essence of their agreement. So to give that kind of unfettered discretion, to glean that from these provisions, I think is really difficult.
Well, you have to take the contract at its word, right? So also the good faith and fair dealing says we cannot write words into the contract. We have to take the contract at its word. And so what you're doing is you're saying, well, these rules and regulations, they have certain contextual elements to them. First of all of those can be changed.
So why are they contextual? They're Exhibit B, or Addendum B. The rules and regulations are established to keep Vivos X Point community safe, secure, peaceful, harmonious, pleasant, comfortable for all bunker leases. So if you suddenly said, Addendum B is now the provision where we address rent, and it's $1 million every month, that seems like it wouldn't necessarily be giving the other party the benefit of their bargain. It would be frustrating the essence of what they came together and contractually agreed to. I don't think you could do that. You think you could?
Yeah, under the terms of the agreement, yes.
How?
Because that's what the modification...
Carve that out for me, provision by provision. How do you get there?
So that's what the modification clause says. So what you're reading into this is a reasonableness in the modification clause. So if you look at all the cases that they cite that try to counter our argument, they all include some sort of constraint. And oftentimes that's reasonableness. So for instance, in the property covenant type cases they cite, they go, well, we need the ability to modify covenants. And what's the holding in that case? The holding in that case is, well, yeah, you can make changes to covenants as long as it's reasonable and not arbitrary and capricious. So if this modification clause said Vivos is allowed to make modifications to the rules as long as it's reasonable, or if as long as it's not arbitrary or capricious, then yes, they would win this argument.
But they have to say the magic words reasonableness? We can't.
They do.
We can't impute that as a legal principle.
They do, because to impute it as a legal principle requires it to be a contract. Like I said, the covenant of fair dealing requires it to be a contract. It's not a contract at its outset. And because of that, the good faith and fair dealing clause does not apply. And so you have to take these terms as they are written, right? There's another canon where we can't change the contract. We can't rewrite the contract for the parties.
But how do the terms that were cited by Justice Salter about keeping the community safe, you know, the idea behind Addendum B, how does that not serve as the constraints you're talking about?
Well, they could be modified. So the modification clause could just take all those out. It could even just put a not in front of it. So say that the Addendum B is not for all these things. There's nothing stopping them from doing that, right? And so what this does is it binds Mr. Sindorf for 99 years to this lease where he has no ability he is at the whim of what they decide, whereas they aren't bound at all. They could, for instance, take a term that Mr. Sindorf didn't want to agree to, wait till he signs the lease, and then add it in. Okay? Or they could take a term they didn't like, and then put it in, and then once he signs the contract, take it out. Right? So it's this unfettered ability to add to the lease. There's nothing that says all these modifications must be contained in the context of Addendum B, because Addendum B can be modified. All that preamble can be modified. There's nothing that says it can be modified as long as it doesn't contradict the lease. They could theoretically modify it to contradict the lease, right? So to not be an illusory promise, you need to have some constraint. And I think where you guys are getting at is, well, let's read in the constraint ourselves. And that's not what the illusory promise doctrine says. What it says is, if it's a illusory promise doctrine, it's not a contract at its outset, and we're not going to read in good intentions or anything like that. The good intentions doctrine is not about whether it's a contract or not.
Well,
it's about once it's a contract.
We're reading this contract together. We're reading the terms together. There's another term which you're well aware of in the lease that says the lease can't be modified without the consent of the parties, right? So you can't unilaterally narrowly and parochially look at some of these provisions that we've been focusing on without understanding that there are other dimensions to the lease which operate very much in tension with your arguments. And so an obligation of any judge in a dispute like this would be to sort of say, hey, well, look, is there a way that these can be read together? Because it's not as if the lease doesn't address changes, and when it does, in a specific provision, it says, you both have to consent to it. So now we have to kind of read those together, don't we?
I think your issue is it's called the lease, and so therefore you conceptually think it's the lease. But the rules are the lease too. And so there's nothing stopping you from changing terms that you think should be in the lease, just slapping them into Addendum B and then changing them that way. So I don't see it as there's the lease and then there's the rules and they're two separate documents. In fact, in their complaint and
so the premise of your argument is you can't ever launch. There is no lease. We aren't reading anything. It's gone. It never happened. And if we don't indulge that premise and rather we try to make a fundamental determination from the get-go that, you know, is that right or not? Does that hold water? Do we have a lease or not? Then we're acting, you know, in a way that would be contrary to your argument. We have to indulge your premise that there's never a lease. They can say whatever they want. They can talk about consent of the parties to modify. Doesn't matter. There's never a lease. It's over.
Well, there was a lease. It's just not enforceable. Right. So they could renegotiate the lease. They could do terms.
No. Actually, there's not a lease. If an illusory promise is not a lease.
Yes.
You said as much.
It's not a contract, right? It's not an enforceable contract.
Well, a lease is a contract.
Yeah, exactly. The terms still exist in the terms that they are written out. It's just not enforceable, was my point.
Yes.
So if I could address the habitability thing for just one quick second. So the habitability thing, I grant that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sloan, you may proceed with rebuttal.
May it please the court. Justice Salter, to answer your question, yes, Vivos's position is Clause 10 says the lease, the material terms, the where, the price, the access, that cannot be modified absent consent and agreement by both parties.
Yeah, Mr. Haynes-McCoy's kind of, you know, it's where you start, you know, and that's a fundamental component of his argument, right? And he would say, gosh, you don't even get to there because there's no lease, there's no relief, there's nothing enforceable, it could say anything.
And I would say that becomes circular at a certain point of if there's not a lease, the eviction action doesn't exist because you can't evict based on. And going past that, the point to the court that Vivos contends is that only the modifications from time to time that's consistent with the guiding principles of Vivos as outlined in Addendum B, and we would assert the covenant of good faith and fair dealing does apply here. And I believe this court in Andres v. Warner, a 1981 decision, held that the best efforts of a purchaser to buy land, that best efforts, the use of doing best efforts, that made a contract not illusory. So we would contend this is a principle that's universally adopted in most covenant situations, most HOA, and especially in light of a 99-year lease, the lessees would expect the community to maintain societal standards that are consistent with when they purchase the property. To Justice Myron's point, yes, I would contend that the basis of what was asserted by Sindorf, it's about damages, and damages are not appropriate in a forcible entry and detainer action. Those damages for unjust enrichment should be brought forward in the other civil action. So we would believe what Vivos's position is, the circuit court.
So does your client have a, I'm sure.
Let's build on that for a second. So since you can't bring it up in an FED action, the fact that they did bring it up and it got that counterclaim got dismissed, that can't be res judicata in a separate action. Because it was not a proper claim in an FED, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm unwilling to concede that.
That was kind of your argument, though.
Well, the argument.
That's kind of how you won on that. You said these are outside of the narrow scope of an FED action.
They're outside of the scope, and
so that would suggest that if they're outside the scope, they should be in some other scope, which they are now.
They are.
And they couldn't have been decided in a proceeding where they're not within the scope, so it can't be res judicata.
Jurisdiction, as you said.
At the same token, that basis is then how the circuit court does not have jurisdiction or an underlying claim to grant the summary judgment in favor of Sindorf. There's no counterclaims or causes of action for the circuit court to have granted summary judgment in affirmance of Sindorf's position. So yes, it would be a separate proceeding that would be best suited for this, and in opposite of the Vore and the Stock decision, this is, you know, starting with a forcible entry and detainer, and instead of being a compulsory counterclaim to join one. So Vivos's position is the narrow issue of possession was not properly addressed by the circuit court. We would ask this court to remand to the circuit court, vacating and reversing the order of the circuit court as to an illusory contract that was not properly before the court. We would ask that this court reverse and remand with the directive of to address only possession, and that be the sole issue for the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. That will conclude the case. We're going to